Right, good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for coming to this LSE Law Department public event, even at such short notice. I'm Emmanuel Melissaris. I'm an associate professor of law here at the Law Department. Let me say a few things by way of housekeeping first. First of all, the event is being recorded, and we're hoping that there will be a podcast next week. I mean, I have to tell you those things in advance. Secondly, we've got it's not on the on the slides, but we do have a hashtag. So if you want to tweet away. The hashtag is LSE Greece. Okay? And the handle, I know what a hashtag is, and I have no idea what a handle is, but it's at LSE Law. So there you go. That's our Twitter account. So today's event is about the significance of the Greek election for Europe as a whole. As you all know, on the 25th of January, 2015, for the first time in Greek history, a party with a radical left-wing agenda, Syriza, which is the Greek acronym for the Coalition of the Radical Left, won the general election in Greece and subsequently formed government in coalition with a right-wing party, the Independent Greeks, with which Syriza has some programmatic convergence on the matter of anti-austerity policy and the sovereign debt. Now, there's no doubt that this has been a European event. It's not just a local event, and its impact has been immediate, it's been direct, and it's already widely felt. So on one level, the significance of the election result for Europe has to do with the question of the Greek sovereign debt and the future of the Eurozone. But it seems that there's a great deal of other tensions that are being revealed here, and these are the tensions that we're going to try and explore in this public event. Some of the antinomies that have surfaced are, on the one hand, solidarity, a Europe of solidarity between states and between people, a Europe of market rationality on the other. Governance on the basis of economic imperatives, and mainly cost efficiency on one hand, democratic authority on the other. It's what Jürgen Habermas called the fiction of sovereignty a couple of years ago in his critique of the German government. Monetary or fiscal or financial union on the one hand, political union on the other. Some people have gone so far as to say that maybe this will trigger a discussion on federalism in Europe. Decision-making through European institutions on the one hand, or decision-making from the bottom up through grassroots political movements and civil society on the other. So we have a fantastic panel of people today who will help us to think about those questions, and I'll introduce them. I'll start with the one who's not here at the table, and that's Paul Mason. Paul will hopefully be able to join us later. He's meant to be able to join us later, but he's on air, not at the moment, but he will be on air on Channel 4 News. Paul had a long career at the BBC. He was a Newsnight business editor, then moved to Channel 4 in 2013 as the culture and digital editor, and since last summer he's the economics editor at Channel 4 News. And he has been really very involved, more than most people, in the Greek crisis. He's been covering it from Greece. He's written a couple of books, not on the crisis, but related issues. And lately he's also produced a short film about the crisis called Greece, the End of Austerity? So Paul will join us later. Simona Talani is the Jean Monnet Chair of European Political Economy at the Department of European International Studies at King's College London over the road. She's the author and editor of many a book on European political economy, but also the Arab Spring in the global political economy. Professor Kostas Douzinas is a professor of law at the Birkbeck School of Law and the director of the Birkbeck Institute for the Humanities. Kostas has written a great deal on legal and political philosophy, but I'll only concentrate on his writings on the Greek crisis over the last 5 years, some of which was consolidated in his book Philosophy and Resistance in the Crisis, which was published by Polity in 2013 and was also translated into Greek. Simon Glendinning is a professor of European philosophy here at the LSE, at the European Institute, and the director of the Forum for European Philosophy. And his research focuses on European philosophy, especially French philosophy. Simon has written a lot on Jacques Derrida. And his current big research project is investigating European identities from a phenomenological perspective. So, we'll start with Simona. Our speakers will speak for about 10-15 minutes or so, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers.
Because half of the audience is my students, so you'll have to see the lecture again, basically.
Only if you can speak in the microphone. It's a small audience, but anyways. Right, let me start. I think what I'll do is basically just introduce the Greek crisis within the context of the Eurozone crisis. So what I will do is simply to talk about how we got there, not so much how we will get out of the crisis, but I think this is can be a subject for the discussion later on. And how did we go there? So obviously this is an interpretation of the crisis, an interpretation which I feel entitled to do simply because I'm a part of, a member of the PIGS. I'm Italian, so I belong to the same group of countries that underwent, let's say, the crisis, that were subject to the crisis from 2010, 2011 onwards. So the interpretation of the crisis that I want to produce today, to propose today, is related to two elements. There are two dimensions there. First, the global financial crisis, and second, the structural imbalances of the economic and monetary union. So my proposal here is to tell you that the Greek crisis, as well as the Eurozone crisis in general, the crisis of sovereign debt for the PIGS is at the intersection between the global financial crisis and the structural imbalances of the economic and monetary union, and to a very much more limited extent is the consequence of the fiscal delinquencies of those countries. Why do I say so? If I had the opportunity to show you some figures, that would be very clear, but some of those countries were not even that delinquent. So some of those countries, and I talk about Spain in particular or Ireland, had not recorded very huge debt-to-GDP ratios before the crisis, and some of those countries had been delinquent forever. So I'm talking about Greece, obviously, and there is a very good book by Vasilis Fouskas that actually shows to what extent Greece has always been in a fiscal crisis, has always been in debt since unification, and he even gives some examples of to what extent this is true. And I'm talking obviously about Italy as well. Italy has always been delinquent in terms of fiscal policy. We had a debt to GDP at entry into the EMU in 1999 of 123%, which is basically what we have at the moment. I think now is even a bit less. And to be precise, after the global financial crisis from 2008 onwards, actually Italy was becoming much more virtuous because the ratio, the deficit to GDP ratio, if you are familiar with this definition, was actually decreasing and was below 6%. It was around 4.5%, and 6% was the average for the Eurozone during the crisis. What does that mean? Actually, to give another example, this country had a deficit to GDP ratio of 13% in 2009, and that was mainly due to the kind of support Britain decided to give to the banking sector, including nationalization of various very important banks. So what does that mean? It means that basically the crisis cannot be related uniquely to the fiscal unreliability of those countries, and is much more related to the fact that the EMU was structurally unbalanced from the beginning. What does that mean? It means simply that there were some elements of the structure of the economic and monetary union, which I don't want to enter into details, you can ask questions later on, that would produce imbalances, especially balance of account imbalances, and especially the deficits of the balance of accounts, which are related to the fact that some countries were by definition gonna be overappreciated, or their real exchange rate would be by definition overappreciated within the economic and monetary union, simply because those countries could not afford to fix the exchange rates from the start. And the reasons are many, including the fact that these are countries which are very prone to inflation, and inflation increased in the course of the 10 years of since when the EMU was established. The data are pretty clear. This is translated in economic terms into a crisis of competitiveness. Crisis of competitiveness is a crisis which is related to the incapacity or the impossibility for those countries to regain the terrain lost in terms of prices, especially prices within the Eurozone and vis-à-vis countries like Germany. So basically the crisis is a crisis of competitiveness. The mistake which was made, no one knows precisely whether voluntarily or involuntarily by the European institutions, was to treat it as a fiscal crisis. And if you treat it as a fiscal crisis, the kind of recipes that you use to resolve the crisis are recipes for disaster, because you're treating the wrong disease. It's not the right disease. And the consequences are for everyone to see. One of the most evident, because if you were trying to treat the fiscal imbalances and the fiscal problems of countries like Greece, you basically did not only didn't help Greek people, recovering, but also you didn't achieve any results in terms of fiscal policy, because at the moment the debt to GDP of Greece is 185%. Which is 60% more than from the beginning of the global financial crisis, which is, even if you had as a name, if your objective was to resolve fiscal problems, the result would have been a disaster. And just to conclude, the point is basically the European institutions, for reasons that we can discuss, were treating the wrong disease. They were not treating the right one, because the right problem was not a fiscal problem, in my opinion, but was much more a problem of structural imbalances of the economic and monetary union as it was established from the beginning. I think it's enough, unless you want to see some graphs.
No. Simone Talenti, thank you very much.
No,
Simon
Talenti.
When I was thinking about what to say this evening, one of the things that I wanted to talk about that I'm not going to talk about is the emergence in Greece of a new political class, a professoriat, replacing a sort of rather inbred political class that had existed for a long time. I think that transformation is interesting. It's in some ways it seems like a large change, but in other ways it's still a sort of upper middle class or a middle upper class group that seems to have come to the fore, and that might be surprising in a movement that is sort of from below in lots of ways. But I'm not going to talk about that. I want to talk about two dimensions of the European event, as Manolis outlined it, and add to those two dimensions one historical one. The two dimensions, one is primarily economic and the other is primarily political. So starting with the economic side, the dimension that I'd like to bring out there is something like the debate or duality of responses to the crisis that are on the one hand grounded in ideas of austerity and on the other hand grounded in ideas of Keynes and the idea of a Keynesian stimulus. In 2008, when the crisis hit, that was a huge sort of central, almost mainstream argument. You know, which way were people going to go? Were you going to follow a more Keynesian route? And there was a lot of work dedicated to showing why, in a position of a financial crisis and massive debt, the thing to do was to spend. But I think the fact that that was such a paradoxical idea to sell publicly, where it's much easier to think of the condition as one where the budget is your own personal budget, and somebody saying you've borrowed all this money, the way to get out of this is to borrow more money, was going to be very difficult to sell. But for whatever variety of reasons, it seems clear that post-2008 and after that initial period in which there was this quite interesting and vital debate between those pro-austerity and those pro-Keynesian stimulus, the second half of this, the Keynesian side, fell away. And it seemed, indeed, that for a long time it looked like it disappeared. And I think that there was quite a general sense in commentators on European economic affairs that we were simply in this age of austerity, as if that was the only position available. Now, what's really interesting about the current leadership of the Greek government, so the people who are currently in positions of ministerial authority in the Syriza government, is that they've resurrected the other side. When they were elected, one of the sort of exciting sounds in the air was a resurrection of something else, which was a much more radical thought of another world is possible. It looked like, you know, this is the movement into some completely new, transformed situation. Well, Keynesian stimulus is not another world. Indeed, it belongs inside the politics of social democracy, which all of this in one way or another is contained in, because the policy strategies are about amelioration of a crisis rather than some kind of fundamental transformation. So just a couple of days ago, it looked as if these two sides were going to be able to come to an agreement. And in fact, it looked like a deal had even been reached. But the Financial Times reported that when all the finance ministers left, having apparently reached some agreement, the Greek finance minister, Varoufakis, phones Athens, and it was vetoed. And I think one of the things we can see there immediately is that any kind of resolution which is going to involve quite serious compromises by everybody is going to be quite hard to sell to the left wing of Syriza. And while we have the finance minister Varoufakis as a left Keynesian, there are wings in his own party which are far more radical and aggressively hostile to the present institutions and structures of the European Union and to the euro. And I can imagine, I would imagine, that he's watching a lot of flanks at once at the moment. We're both trying to work out the way to strategically reach some sort of settlement within the European Union, but also trying to reach a settlement that can be accepted by his party. One of the difficulties I think that Syriza will face, this is a sort of prediction, but it's almost a banality, is that the far left in politics is particularly vulnerable to factionalism. And because Syriza is a constellation of different groups, it's quite possible that there are people who, for the moment, are satisfied that Varoufakis can take a lead on this. If he fails, I'm sure there'll be others very ready to stand in his place. So that's one dimension, is this austerity Keynes debate, which is being played out at the moment, but may turn. It, particularly if there's no agreement reached, then I would imagine that governments in the European Union, apart from Greece, understand that quite well. The other dimension that the Greek event, or this European event through Greece, seems to me to have raised up is a political dimension, which was raised by Simona, about whether the crisis will itself be a motor towards some kind of development within the trajectory of the European Union itself. And so if the first one's austerity and Keynes, the second one is the nation and the supranational, or the national and the supranational. And Habermas, who was mentioned earlier, has sided strongly with the Keynesian left, but he does so in a way that sees austerity as bound up with a particular political formation of the union itself. He thinks it doesn't just reflect a kind of one-sided economics, but also a one-sided politics, which is producing a crisis far more damaging than the problem it aims to solve. Now, he promotes the idea in this that the way out of the crisis, if it's going to be a properly political solution, has to be one in which the Eurozone, at least, but the EU altogether, he would hope, turns from being an economic union to being a properly political union. And he said that the way it stands at the moment treats national governments and citizens alike as underage children. So he thinks that the current setup and the technocracy of the EU bureaucracy and its democratic shortcomings is a sort of offence to the member nations. But of course what he wants in his turn is greater control from a European level body and rapid movements towards closer European integration and debt sharing and so on, alongside an increased democratic input where the supranational government of Europe would also be a supranational democracy. And one could think that this ambition to reduce the role of national governments to what he calls implementing authorities is an even more serious way of treating national governments like underage children. They're not to have any proper control at all. And so one of the problems of the crisis has shown up is that the economic union isn't underpinned by a political union, and yet if it was to be underpinned by a political union, it's not clear at all whether nations would even will it. So this idea of it not being the will of the nations to form a supranational political union in Europe goes right back to the work of Immanuel Kant, who said that however ideal a European-level government would be in terms of being able to coordinate both economically and politically, it's not, he said, the will of the nations. What he didn't ask is who could will it then? And there are two contexts, I think, in which one can imagine it being willed. One is a nation in ruins, a nation so completely devastated that the chances of it being able to secure for itself any enduring future was so weak that entering into a supranational state where somebody where there's a new sovereign, where competences have all been moved upstairs, would be acceptable. The other side of that is a nation with extraordinary power who could identify the interests of the supranational government as its own interests, as essentially in keeping with its own interests, so that it would have effectively become, as it were, the master in this union. Well, that's an odd setup, but it's also rather reminiscent of the situation we're in now, where tragically, Greece is in considerable ruins. I don't know if anybody's going to speak to this tonight, but I don't think we should forget quite how terrible and grim the situation is, and certainly was, in Greece in the last few years. And the failure of businesses, suicides, just an unbelievable level of poverty and impoverishment for ordinary people is something that in Britain, where you know people say, oh, it's happened in Greece, now it'll happen in Britain. The situation is in many ways deeply incomparable, and it has been awful. So I think that the situation is one where we could have seen Greece succumb to an idea that really let's push now for a serious form of European integration and debt sharing, which will, as it were, get us out of that. But then, of course, they will have sacrificed their opportunities for national sovereignty in so doing. And instead, what we've seen is an extraordinary effort of Greece not to lie down in its ruins. And I think it's an extraordinary event for that reason. I think it's another demonstration of Kant's thought that a union constituted by its members is not to be one in which the members become mere implementing authorities, as Habermas puts it. So those are two sort of economic and political dimensions, and I want to briefly, if I can, mention one other, which is I call philosophical history. Now, there's been a lot of invoking of national stereotypes in the way that the news from Greece and the role of Germany is represented. You have the Greek drama, the Greek tragedy, how Spartan is Sparta. Greek democracy, of course, another kind of fantastic image. And on the other hand, you have the German hegemon, German resolve, the unflinching iron will of German moral sense. And of course, you also have in that the unusual factor that in German language, the word for guilt and the word for debt is the same, Schuld and Schulden, both connected with responsibility of what you've done or what you owe. A debt that you could never pay off would be a kind of primordial guilt. So we have these stereotypes in play, but there is something that this sort of draws in its wake, however sort of superficial it is. You have Germany, or Germans, or populists in Germany complaining about Greek profligacy when debt was cheap, and so debt was high, so guilt was high, and no reforms or inappropriate reforms or insufficient reforms. And in fact, of course, we should remember that tax issues are very serious in Greece, as the Syriza government has made clear. Cooked books. You know, we could go in for this for ages, but if you compare, let's say, not Germany again, but say Greece with Norway, Norway's out of the EU, but it's, as it were, very rigorous in the way it collects taxes, where every single full stop's drawn in and the books are perfect, pristine cleanliness, and you compare it to Greece, where you're kind of completely mad if you pay everything, because nobody pays completely everything. You've got very different cultures there. But in the midst of Greek ruination in the crisis, Germany does exceptionally well. And one should say perhaps shamefully well, owing a great debt to Greek misery. And so you have this extraordinary play going on here, this drama between the Greeks and the Germans. And underlying that, I'd say there is a sort of interesting philosophical history. On the one hand, you do have Greece, which is represented in the history of the West as a certain kind of origin, not just of democracy, but of a culture of questioning, where nothing's taken for granted, but also in its philosophy, opening the space for science, and then science unfolding in history into modern technical modernity, which in a certain way it now suffers from, which is a problem. And on the other side, you have you have the Greek origin. On the other side of that, you have the German question, which is what is Germany? Now, unification in 1871 and reunification in 1990 might have thought to have answered that with some kind of state-like formation. Germany is some kind of state. But Germany's history is absolutely inseparable from a European space. When Germany tells itself its own history, it will very often begin with the Greeks and talk about the way that the Greek world is overwhelmed and overthrown by the Roman world, and then the Roman world in turn crumbling and being overwhelmed by a barbarian culture, which is, of course, is Germany, or German. And then developing out of that a Holy Roman Empire of the German peoples, which goes back to the 13th century, but also sort of has its origins in the 800s. So that you have in the history of Europe a sort of movement towards a large, enlarged German space and a large German power. If you look at the maps of the Holy Roman Empire at its strongest, it's a very deeply European space. And so on the one hand, you have in that history a Germanization of Europe. And after the Second World War, there were many calls for the Europeanization of Germany, as it were, as to come back to some kind of comradely or solidaristic presence in Europe. But there is a problem in that. If Europe is already a German thing, then the Europeanization of Germany is just another way of talking about the Germanization of Europe. So I'm not sure what the stability is of the current situation. I hope that the left Keynesians in the Syriza group can get agreement. My guess is that they will. But it probably will leave intact a lot of the old problems of the euro as lacking a political underpinning, and of Greece still in a terrible condition.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Manolis, and thank you, Emily, and the law department. Of course, the law department of the LSE is my alma mater. I carried out my doctoral research and started my career here back in the early 80s, and it is great, great pleasure to come back. And of course, some Greece-related events at the LSE gave people occasionally the impression that they were carrying out PR for the previous government and austerity. And I hope that this event now will perhaps start a new process of examining Greece and Greek-related events or German-created events at the LSE. Now, my job here is basically to keep you entertained until Paul arrives, okay? So I have a talk which can be extended and contracted as needs demand. So let me start with a joke. This man arrives at the Athens airport and goes to immigration control. The immigration officer asks, nationality? German. Occupation? No, I love Greece, I'm here for holidays. Now, those of you who are doing... No, you got it now, good. Those of you who are doing law, you know that we do those so-called hypotheticals. So let us imagine what would be the answer of the immigration officer of the Greek state, in other words, before the January elections and after the January now. Now, before the January elections, a pretty reasonable answer of the Greek state would be, okay, holidays, but I think it would be very important to tell us what to do and indeed to lend us a few bob as well. Lend us a few euros so we can pay back the old debt. Today, the answer would be, I think, holidays, mate? Great, you're joining the great resistance revolutionary tourism that Greece needs these days. And I want to put my cards on the table before saying anything else. I returned from Athens 2 days ago, and the month I spent there, before and after the elections, was perhaps the happiest month in my, at least, public life. The change in mood, in attitude, in gesture is palpable. It is amazing, particularly for those of you who have been to Greece and remember the kind of melancholy, sadness, that kind of withdrawal and abandonment that was everywhere in Athens and all over Greece. People are smiling, people are kissing strangers in the street, in these rallies and demonstrations of support for the new government, totally spontaneous rallies, people really feel that something new has happened. The key slogan that was being chanted at these rallies was that bring back the riot police. There cannot be a demonstration without tear gas. Because this was the first time that the riot police was not there. And that sense of incredulity, of something has happened that is quite unexpected, that I will wake up tomorrow and the whole thing will disappear, is everywhere in the streets and amongst the people. And yet, the victory celebrations, those of you who were there at the time in Athens, were muted, were restrained, emotional but restrained. I think they represent the mood of a nation torn between the invented tradition of a glorious past and a traumatic history of state repression, of corrupt and dynastic politics that we hope is now going away. Now, there is a standard cliché that we read in the newspapers, both British and other languages, that the Syriza victory was a historic event. And what I want to then do in the next couple of minutes or 5 minutes is precisely to say a few things about the historic or otherwise nature of that victory. My claim has been that the victory and the new government marks the end of two historic periods, two concentric cycles, and starts or restarts a third. The cycles are 1949, 1968-69, and 1989. 1949 and 89 are coming to an end, or the beginning of the end is appearing. 1968 is restarting. Now, of course, 1949 is the year of the beginning of the Cold War, in Greece of the end of the Civil War, as a result of which a quite sharp divide between left and right was introduced into Greek society and politics. Indeed, the politics that followed 1949 was a politics of anomaly, which culminated with the colonel's dictatorship in 1967. Those people who had resisted the Nazi occupation, but had been defeated, of course, in the Civil War, found themselves persecuted, exiled, imprisoned. And that kind of subdivide, in a sense, determined the whole trajectory of Greek society and culture until, I believe, today, until the series of victory in 2015. The left accepted its political defeat and theoretical failure and retreated to a position that one could call of left melancholy and of a kind of narcissism or small differences between the different groupings. 1989, of course, is the year of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Fukuyama announced the end of history. President Bush announced the new world order. Neoliberal capitalism was supposed to be the last stage in humanity's history or progress. This is precisely the system that failed spectacularly and structurally in 1989. The Queen here in London, here at the LSE indeed, in November of 2008, after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, asked an anonymous, but apparently very smart, professor of economics, if this was so big, the collapse, how come that smart people like you missed it? We don't have the answer of this LSE professor, and of course the LSE economics people have propagated this kind of endemically problematic
theory, macroeconomic theory, and they have great responsibility for what has happened. Because the failure of that type of macroeconomics, of economic theory, is endemic, is structural, it is unavoidable. I think people mentioned earlier, to give you a couple of examples from Greece, mentioned earlier by, I think, Simon or Simone, the ratio to GDP, to the ratio of GDP to debt in Greece was 125 or 120 in 2009, and now, after 5 years of the most aggressive austerity policies in at peacetime, it is 185 of GDP. The IMF admitted in 2012 that they had seriously failed, they had made a serious mistake in relation to the so-called fiscal multiplier, which is in reality the effect of austerity upon the real economy. They had underestimated by a factor of 3, and then they persisted with exactly the same policies. This is what in psychoanalysis we would call fetishistic disavowal. In other words, I know what I'm saying is wrong, but I'm acting as if actually I were right. Indeed, if we turn to Europe now, because we heard a few things, very interesting things from Simon. In 2002, Jürgen Habermas and Ulrich Beck, the late and lamented Ulrich Beck, published books in which, hailing the unification of Germany, the introduction of the euro, the expansion to the east of the European Union, they claim that the 21st will be the European century, that the future of humanity was Europe and the European model, following, in Habermas's case, the old Kantian idea of cosmopolitanism and so on. Many the successes of the model, they claim. The European century will replace the atrocious 20th American century. Indeed, the first sentence of Ulrich Beck's book German Europe, published in 2013, reads as follows. In February 2012, I was aghast, horrified, to hear in the news that the German Bundestag, the German Federal Bank, would decide today, in 2012, the future of Greece. And of course, he goes on to explain why Europe should not be German, but ends up with a pretty similar cosmopolitan plan, design, which of course, I think, as Simon was saying, ends up being more or less a German model. Now, of course, the German Bundestag did not really decide the future of Greece in February 2012. The Greek elites, those of you who have followed the Greek tragedy or whatever, have parodied for some 5 years the famous question posed by Freud, an unanswered question: what does the woman want? It is, according to Freud, in psychoanalysis, an unanswerable question. So they kept asking, what does Mrs. Merkel want? Mrs. Merkel want? And of course, Mrs. Merkel sometimes would say, we want Greece in the euro. Sometimes, we want Greece out of the euro. Most of the times, she would not answer, what does the woman want? And then, of course, the Greek elite, trying to decipher the desire of Mrs. Merkel, kept cutting salaries, cutting pensions, sacking people, creating the conditions that we know. It is only when this new government went up to Mrs. Merkel and the Europeans and said, sorry, we don't want your money anymore. We don't want to borrow any more money in order to pay previous loans, that cycle of desire, partial satisfaction, and frustration hopefully came to an end. And
Simon said a number of things about left Keynesians and others. I am very actively involved in what is happening. Perhaps we could discuss the details and not base ourselves exclusively in information from the Financial Times. Okay. We can now, it seems to me, understand the Greek predicament, which is also the European predicament. On the one hand, a greedy neoliberal type of capitalism. Oxfam published a report only about a month ago in which they found that 1% of the world's super rich own 50% of the world's wealth. This is precisely the logical outcome. It's becoming worse. The trend is moving in that direction. It's becoming worse as we're moving in the future. And of course, the second problem is the lack of democracy, what we would call the post-democratic or the post-political condition we live in. So let us move back to Greece. How did we get there? Why did Greece is in the position it is now? Why Syriza? Now, of course, the deprivations, degradations of the Greek people, Simon mentioned them, are well known. I'm not going to mention them anymore. However, what has been missed by the commentators and by the people discussing the Greek situation is the fact that over 4 or 5 years, the Greek people resisted consistently with great strength and perseverance and great imagination. And indeed, in terms of resistance, what happened in Greece and in Athens in particular was 3 or 4 years ahead of what was happening at the same time in Spain or in Ireland, let alone Italy. So what, in a sense, took the European elites by surprise, which had used Greece as a guinea pig in order to test the restructuring of capitalism in conditions of acute crisis, was precisely the resistance of these people. Those people who basically, from guinea pigs, from objects of intervention, became eventually political subjects and took over the lab, in a sense. Now, in a series of articles I published in the Guardian newspaper in 2010, 11, and 12, I predicted that the European Spring would start in Athens. And everyone, my friends and my enemies, they all said that I was mad. And perhaps I was. Where did I base that kind of strategic optimism, as I called it, and I still carry it very proudly? First, and talking about philosophy of history, there comes a point in history where a particular social, political, and economic system has run its course, has become obsolete and harmful. Now, of course, that is not enough for the change. You need, second, the political subject who is prepared to take part, and third, a spark, a catalyst, something that brings together the wide popular rejection of the existing system and the political subject, and in that sense, leads to the change. All three factors existed in Greece, and in a sense they were consummated last month. You had a huge rejection of the economic system, particularly of the corrupt old elites. You had the political party prepared to take part, and then you had the catalyst, which was, of course, the memoranda and the austerity policies and the Troika. And it was based on my optimism, on an understanding of those resistances. Over 4 years, as I said, multiform and persistent types of resistance took place all over Greece. They culminated with the occupation of Syntagma Square and a number of other squares in 2011. 3 months, people in those squares, without a common ideology, without a party leading them, without any common sense except for the political desire to get rid of that economic and political system, exercised direct democracy. Nobody had told them about it. They had not read Hardenegri or Zizek or Badiou. They just did it.
in popular assemblies daily, in working groups which covered all the major social services that a state provides efficiently. They learned how to organize their lives. And they, in a sense, prefigured a new institutional, even constitutional system in which direct and horizontal democracy and collaboration and social economy becomes a key part of its operation. When those resistant people, those multitudes, to use the fashionable term, became a people, in other words, were asked to go and vote in elections in 2012, in 2014, and now they adopted Syriza. But why Syriza? Why Syriza? A number of parties were actually resisting austerity. The first thing to say is that, I mean, if we're honest, and you know, I belong to that kind of field, between 2008-09 and 2015, Syriza did not do any great things. It was a small party of 4%, moved to 37% because precisely it was adopted. People chose Syriza, and I think some of the key reasons why they chose Syriza instead of other anti-austerity parties was precisely the fact that it is an internal democratic party. It used to have a number of constituencies, small groups and constituent organizations, fully democratic. Hi, Paul. So I'm finishing, so, you know, sort of it's very, very timely. Fully democratic, and that kind of democratic approach continued even after the party was unified. So now we come, and I want to finish with the future. What does the future hold? In what way can the Syriza government succeed? And based on my analysis and the few things I said today, clearly, once we move out of the immediate problems of debt and so on, I'm sure Paul will give us the good news perhaps in a minute, since it was the resistances, and particularly the occupations, and the Syntagma occupation, which actually led to this victory, or was a major contributing factor, Syriza government has to learn from these experiences. In other words, it has to use those ideas of direct democracy, of horizontal networking, of social economy. When the squares emptied, and people went back to towns and villages and neighborhoods, some 3,000 solidarity movements were created, covering everything from social clinics and health to solidarity and soup kitchens to helping immigrants, helping the poor. That kind of huge know-how that has now been created will, I'm sure, be gradually transferred onto the state sector and start building a new way of organizing the state and social services that will be unprecedented. And in that sense, I would claim that Syriza and the Syriza government, if it succeeds, might be also the beginning of a new, different Europe. But will it succeed? And let me finish here. Will a Syriza government succeed? To anticipate tomorrow's festival, you know, Valentine's and all that, there are acts you prepare for. You take account of the pros and the cons and all the rest of it, and others that hit you on the head, like a miracle, an earthquake. You are never ready to fall in love, and you are never ready to start a revolution. As I said, it hits you on the head. The French, it falls on you. You fall in love. The French have this wonderful expression, coup de foudre, hits you on the head. This is what happened to Syriza. It was adopted, as I said. And having been adopted, it must succeed. It is bound to succeed in a deeper sense, that sense of the call, of a historical call that you don't expect, you don't perhaps want even. And then it hits you, and you have to do it. So while Syriza has set out a detailed program, the Syriza economists, including Mr. Varoufakis, are as good economists as any we had in the Ministry of Economics and Finance, with international recognition and reputation and so on. On the other hand, a program, a policy, a plan, and I can tell you with good knowledge, there existed a program and a policy and a plan. People were working, no opposition party in Greece, but I think in most European countries, had done so much work preparing for a possible victory as a series of people in Kadu had done before the elections. But on the other hand, you always have the unexpected, perhaps the event, something for which you cannot plan. So you need on the one hand the plan, you need on the one hand the government and the ministries and the bills in parliament, and on the other hand the social mobilization, the ballot box in the street. Those two things have to go together. You have to be absolutely principled, but at the same time totally pragmatic. In order to follow your principles, you have to be pragmatic in relation to the means that you choose. So, to finish, those of you who live here, just came back, but you have been talking to people, realize that something has happened in Greece that has wider repercussions. And it has wider repercussions when people realize that the Greek change, the new Greek government, means something for us here in London or in Paris or in Rome or in Madrid. Because this is the way that paradigm shifts happen, because that is my claim. We are at the beginning, perhaps, of a paradigm shift that may work in Greece, but it will work certainly only if a new way of understanding the world, whether it is a left Keynesian or something else, should be discussed later, but that this new paradigm shift is on the way. Once we have that, then it seems to me the future of Europe would be much better. Something started in Athens, but cannot succeed either in Athens or anywhere else without the support, the solidarity, and I think the commitment of people in this country, in Britain, along ideas not dissimilar from those that Syriza has put on the historical agenda for the first time in Europe since the war. Thank you.
Kostas, thank you very much. Paul, welcome. I've already introduced you in your absence.
Thank you.
I'm
confident that you will get in. I will get in. Okay. Sorry for my late arrival, everybody. I've just knocked the screen off as well. Anyway, that was me. I'm the economics editor of Channel 4 News. I'm also the author of a book called Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, which is about the Arab Spring, the Occupy movement, and the Plataeus movement in Syntagma. I can't remember what it's called in Greek, but it begins O Cosmos or something. So, just come back from the Brussels summit, which I'll talk about in a minute. And I was three times in Greece during the election campaign, including the end of it. I'm also working with an independent documentary team who were there throughout the entire period and are still there, trying to gather a lot of evidence and documentary evidence about what it is that these social movements that Kostas is talking about. And I'll talk a bit about that as well. And I'm really sorry that I didn't get a chance to hear what the other people said, because I was really keen to get here to hear. I've been in Brussels land a little bit too much, and just got back this today, and before that was a bit too much in Syriza land. So I'm trying to give myself a space in my head to think about what happened. Let's talk about three things: why they won, current situation in the negotiations, which I'm sure you're keen to hear about, and then what I think it means for European and Greek institutions. And we can do that in 10 minutes. Since about 2012, I think Syriza, when I covered the election there, had 27% of the vote. There is about, I think, 27% of society that is centre-left and left and social democratic. And so, you know, that vote moved more or less en masse from the two sources we know about. PASOK, the Social Democratic Party, which more or less killed itself, collapsed by signing the signing the memorandum. I think it killed itself not only by signing the memorandum, but by advancing, I think in hindsight, you have to say, Venizelos, the sort of old-style wing of social democracy. What were they up against? You would hear again and again young technocrats inside PASOK saying, you know, it's like Godfather 2. It's like that party that Michael Corleone throws at the start of on Lake Tahoe, at the start of the movie. And we just don't want to be part of it. It's not just the austerity. So the young social democratic technocrats could not see a way forward. You look at Varoufakis, you know, ex-PASOK advisor. I think he came over earlier because of his critiques of neoliberal economics, but he's not the only kind of person like that who that's happened to. But then from 2012 until now, I think one of the other reasons, things that's driven people, obviously they've soaked up the KKE's soft vote as well, the communist vote. If you look at the very end, just before they go into the election, they recruit our fellow academic here from SOAS, Kostas Lapavitsas, who was very critical of their position, of Syriza's position on the euro, and he wants euro exit. But he is, you know, it was touch and go whether they would have him as an MP. He becomes an MP. He stumps around. He is able to turn a four MP constituency from four New Democracy MPs, four right-wing MPs, largely rural and suburban in Thessaloniki, in Salonika, to four Syriza. So they do. So they soak up that sort of hard, sort of slightly conservative, slightly more nationalist, and you know, in some sense, Stalinist vote. But I think what they crucially do is something else. The youth see what New Democracy and PASOK in government did about Golden Dawn. And Golden Dawn, as any Democrat, you know, I've interviewed them, I've interviewed their leaders, I've confronted their members on the street, are a true fascist party. And to see so-called Democrats just try go to them in secret and send emissaries to do deals with them, you know, over the, which they, you know, it was taped, the deal that Samaras's envoy tried to do with them. To see people in people from Laos and people from, you know, former Golden Dawn members, like the minister, what's his name? Is it Georgiades? Former axe-wielding youth leader of Golden Dawn, inside the government for New Boridis, sorry, yeah. Just turned a lot of people off. And I think that's what gives them the 32%. Then what gives them 36, 37% is an amazing surge towards the end, where they actually look like a government. I've been criticised by a lot of lefties for saying it's because Tsipras and Duru, who is the prefect of Attica, look like real politicians, and it's all the masses, and it's all social movements. No, yes, social movements get you to 30%, but looking like a prime minister and being confident and not having crazy MPs on TV doing their own party political broadcasts on YouTube, like with their iPhones, makes you look like you're going to win. So that's how they won. My documentary, there's 15 minutes worth, but just Google it, Greece, the End of Austerity, has got an amazing sequence in it where Syriza go to these villages in Corinthia and you know, the former castles of the New Democracy were going 37% Syriza, you know, 26% New Democracy, 7% Golden Dawn, virtually mirroring the national results. When you ask them why, two-thirds of the land is in foreclosure. All they want is to grow. All they want to do is grow grapes. But they mortgage their land. Piraeus Bank, in trouble, dodgily, you know, kind of politically run, is foreclosing them. They're not, you know, they're not going to vote for the party that is mates with the boss of the bank. So that's why I think they won. Situation now is really it's moving quite rapidly. So in the last 48 hours, so Wednesday night, Thursday, what was happening is the Greeks are trying to do, the Syriza Varoufakis and his team are trying to do a compromise, whereby, having said they're going to push for their entire program and break the bailout program with the Troika, they have actually accepted a form of continuation of the bailout program and only pursuing 30% of their demands. That's what their actual negotiating position is. I can tell you, I know, without saying the source, completely 100% true, that is what they're trying to do. Now, twice in the last 48 hours, they got agreement with Dijsselbloem, the finance minister of Holland, who negotiates on behalf of the Eurogroup, but twice Schäuble vetoed it. When they'd actually got a form of words of agreement, it's always about whether the programme is a revised version of the programme and whether they are, quotes, allowed to address Greece's humanitarian needs. But Merkel gets off the plane, having apparently saved the world over Ukraine, and seems to force Schäuble to stop nixing it. So they're there now, the Greek team in Brussels, minus Varoufakis, who's gone back, and they're trying to do... they're fairly confident they can get there. My own personal opinion is I still think the Germans are going to pull some kind of move, because I move in a world of journalists who cover finance. We've been covering this. We know how the European Union and ECB work. And I know from personal experience just how traumatised what I would call mainstream neoliberal journalists are over the non-appearance of their central strategy, which was, or their central scenario, which was Grexit or total U-turn by Tsipras. They used to absolutely fantasise that Tsipras would in some way, like you know, Tony Blair or something, just turn around and impose austerity. These guys have no understanding whatsoever of what... You know, all right, you know, we know how far Syriza has come as a party politically from the left towards the centre, but they have no understanding of the culture, no understanding that around 30% of Greek dinner tables, you know, the discussion on the night of victory was about their granddads who were tortured in the camps, either during, you know, either the prisons, either during the civil war or under the junta or under the Nazis indeed. They've got no understanding that that's where he comes from, and therefore they've no understanding of what's going to hit them, and it's going to be very traumatic, I think, for the European central right, you know, the FT, the Wall Street Journal, the kind of Reuters guys, because they haven't had to sit there like New Democracy and PASOK have sat there for 2 years watching the world fall apart. For them, the world falls apart on Monday with no warning. Because the world falling apart is Tsipras coming home saying, I've done a deal, we've got 6 months, now prefecture of police. Now the criminology lecturer, who is the police minister, is going to get to work. Now the migrants have risen up in one of the camps, in one of the detention centres. We're not going to deal with that in the old way. It's going to be a complete mind-bending moment. So, that's where we are. I expect there to be a deal that gives them 4 months' grace. Of course, it doesn't solve the debt problem. I think the hot re-entry, as the French call it, you know, is going to happen because you've got workers, you've got youth, want things from that government. So that's where I think we are. Now, what I think the challenge is for politics, and this is sort of law and politics kind of milieu, aren't we? It was the 70th anniversary of Varkis yesterday, the peace deal that the Greek Communist Party and resistance movement did with the Brits when they arrived to liberate Greece. And it's a traumatic moment. I've just rewatched some of the footage where the Greek resistance fighters stacked their weapons and they're all bursting into tears, the beardy guerrilla fighters. The deal was supposed to be a democratic constitution, and instead they got 2 years of civil war and, you know, 70 years. They would argue, by the right and by an oligarchy. Make no mistake that Syriza's long-term cadres and activists see this as the end of the post-Varkas era, not the end of post-junta or even post-civil war. This is ending an era that goes back to February 1945. I think it's the end of several eras, because it is also the end of the democratic two-party system that post-1974 was put into place. If you look at Syriza's, the current polls, Syriza's on something like 45% if there were an election now. And all of that comes from New Democracy. New Democracy has gone down to 18. Some of it comes from all the others, Golden Dawn and whatever. But it is a swing by the populist centre-right to supporting Syriza, because, as you'll know if you've been anywhere near Athens the last 12 days, what people are saying is that at last somebody stood up for the country. It's not a left-right thing anymore. Mm. I've written about this, and I've also warned how dangerous that can get, because it isn't, you know, farmers who only know Tsipras as Alexei and don't even know the name of the party. It's deep into the rural hinterlands this is going. What does it mean? We've seen the destruction of the centre. I think we're going to see a new issue for a party that I've tried to understand and report on, Topotami, the new centre-left that's invented itself to try and replace PASOK. Because what if Tsipras comes back with this only a third of his programme intact and starts implementing it? I think politicians to the right of him with inside Syriza, which I would include Varoufakis and I would include Rina Duru, in terms of, we're talking about shades of opinion here, actually what it's doing, they aren't going to invent their own Topotami. That's what they've done. They've done a deal with Europe that everybody else said would be a disaster and impossible. It's going to be really hard to be a centre-left politician in Greece in the next few weeks if they come back with a deal. The next thing it's going to be hard to be is the state, because this state has been, as Yanis Palaiologos writes in his book, the 16th Labour of Sisyphus, you know, it's a state that was completely divided up by oligarchs, and he writes, of course, critically unions as well and working class interests. But it is going to be reformed. So it's the first reform of a post-Cold War state that we're going to see. For political scientists, very interesting. Mm-hmm. European social democracy, I can tell you, it is having a massive effect on European social democracy. Renzi, when Tsipras walks in there, it's like Renzi has seen Father Christmas. Even though he doesn't agree with him programmatically, but you see, Nicola Sturgeon came down yesterday to do a big interview set in Britain. She came with a clear demand of less austerity for the SNP, and I know that it's having a big effect, a magnetic effect on Labour, even though they're not going to go into the election with any change on their austerity programme. The leeway built in to the possibilities, the fiscal possibilities for Britain, are such that I think it means that if a positive scenario emerges of higher growth than expected in Britain, and you have what is therefore called, you know, a bigger output gap than we expected, it's fairly clear that the heart of Labour now in the leadership would be to take the upside and do no more austerity at all. And that's under the pressure of the SNP and of Syriza. So to finish, the one final thing is the EU institutions. The EU institutions have been moulded around a neoliberal treaty, the Amsterdam Treaty, the Maastricht Treaty. They have a practice that assumes neoliberalism as the default. So we didn't know until now how much of it was institutional and how much of it was practice, if you see what I mean. And it turns out quite a lot of it is practice, because you're going to get, I think quite soon, a replacement ECB member from Greece. Stournaras was political appointee. He's supposed to go on for 5 years. He won't. So the ECB is not going to have a guy sitting there in the council who is against neoliberalism. And so are, you can name them, every institution, the council, the commission. You know, it's going to end up, because I think the presidency is going to end up with a new EU commissioner as well. This is just totally mind-blowing. Of course, if you then add in Podemos by December, we are in a really interesting situation in Europe. But I think whatever your position is on Syriza, whether you like him or not, they have actually created almost a revolution in the institutions. That's it.
Right. There you go. Hot off the press. 45%. Blimey. Okay. Let's take questions. May I please ask you to be as brief as possible and to introduce yourselves first, very briefly. There are a couple of microphones going around. Questions? Yes.
Christos Kurtelis, teaching fellow at King's College. One question for Simone, of course. The question is, Simone, if you want to elaborate a bit more on the reasons why the Eurozone leaders pursued the catastrophic policies for dealing with the crisis. The other question is for Kostas and Paul. You said that Syriza has invested a lot of time in order to design very carefully an economic program for the future of the country. I agree with this. But as you said, Paul, Lapavitsas argues, you know, for a Grexit. I think he represents...
No longer.
Yes.
Now okay. Is
well, to yeah. not to use the euro, actually. My question is not about the restructuring of the debt. I think this will be solved in one way or the other. But the economic program of Syriza, in my opinion, in the longer run, will have to clash with a very dense apparatus that is created for the last 30 years in the EU, from the SEA until today. And it will clash with the industrial and competition policy, which is not at the hands of the member states anymore. So this is my worry for severe infringements or decisions by the ECJ regarding some decisions that the Greek government has to take if it wants to implement a successful industrial policy.
Thank you, Christos. I mean, this is a very good question, and it's not an easy one to answer, because one can give different answers to this. You can simply say that institutionally the EU is implementing neoliberal policies, as we has been said already by Paul, because they have a sort of a bias towards neoliberalism, a kind of by definition they will do it. My impression is that, as you all know, ideologies or ideas are normally for someone and for some purposes. So I got the feeling that from some quarters that was an intended consequence to kind of control, let's say, the developments, institutional and political developments, and even the economic ones in the periphery. That is my opinion. So there was an idea, in a way they undervalued the consequences of austerity. They thought that austerity could be stopped, or at least that would not have general consequences. Indeed, it did have some general consequences. I don't think about Greece. I think if the problem were only Greece, we wouldn't be at this stage now. We wouldn't have, negotiations between Syriza and the EU institutions. If the problem were Italy, we wouldn't be there. The problem is that you have deflation in Europe, and deflation is a problem for all of the countries. It's not only a problem for Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland. This is a serious problem. It's not serious in the UK, because in the UK deflation is because of oil and energy, and everyone knows that, but it's much more serious in other countries. And if you see, I mean, we've been talking about Germany a lot, and Germany is the bad guy. Germany is not a bad guy. They're just a normal country which is doing their own interests, not to talk about maybe some sectors within it. And they were lucky to a certain extent that everyone else was not realizing the consequences of the economic and monetary union. But now everyone is realizing the consequences of austerity, including Germany. This is why Mrs. Merkel will most likely accept negotiations with Tsipras, and also on the same terms. Of course, it's a compromise, but in a way Syriza is a good excuse to leave austerity, you know, a way to just make austerity disappear as an issue. And they all say, it's not us, it was because of Tsipras, it was because of Syriza, and they can all explain it like this, and it will be easy to do. But it's not, for me, it's not this, it's this inflation, the problem.
I want to just talk about this institutional question that you raised. The average centrist politician for two generations now is somebody who might have an ideological conviction, maybe to neoliberal economics, but really their political science education is like, you know, it's the biography of LBJ. Some of the intellectual sources of Blairism, like, you know, the Third Way, and generally they'll float through life, sort of picking up good ideas and thinking of politics as policy. But that's why very few of them are good at strategy or operations, certainly in a place like Britain, but also Germany. They're administrators. Even if you're in Syriza, if you're one of the sort of people sitting around the cabinet table or some of the operators they've now got running ministries, you may have made a journey away from Marxism as a politics, but as a mode of operating, it remains a very strong culture inside Syriza. And, you know, Antonio Gramsci, you know, required reading on this part of the European left, said that the party should be the modern prince, that it should operate like the Machiavelli. And everybody I know in Syriza understands that. So the European centrist elite is now up against a machine that, even though it's not Stalinist, even though it no longer has these, you know, these Orthodox Marxist features in its politics, understands a way of operating the state in that way. In other words, they come armed with a class analysis of the police force. When they do their police reforms, they will understand this unit is based in the countryside. This one is New Democracy. These are fascists. Bourgeois politicians don't think in that way. And I think this is going to be the very interesting clash. It's not just a clash between left and right. It's a clash between two ways of thinking about the state. And I think this is also going to be the thing that answers your question about the diplomacy. Yes, the ECJ can do X, Y, and Z. But what will happen is that we'll come armed diplomats who understand if you do this, we also have a chess piece to move here. You know, you say our fruit and veg can't be exported to Russia. And we've got some border guards, but we need them somewhere else. The Balkans are the Balkans. I think this will happen. There will be a very interesting chess match using the ECJ and all sorts of other things that's never happened before.
Can I add a couple of things? First, in relation to the differences within Syriza and the Syriza leadership that I think everyone mentioned in the past. I think that kind of approach, I don't want to in any way reduce the importance of some policy difference or indeed ideological provenance and so on. However, that kind of approach starts from a position which says that basically a party has to be totally united, you must have a leader who, you know, somehow articulates the policy and everyone kind of sort of falls behind. You know, the democratic centralist idea of the Communist Party, which is now being projected, however, around the strong leaders, whether it is Cameron or Blair or whatever. And it seems to me that having different views which are articulated within the party and lead to a debate and lead perhaps to some kind of synthesis, as it has happened so far in Syriza, is not a bad thing altogether. That is the first point I want to make. So I think we tend, because this is kind of the media thing, tend to over-exaggerate, you know, so those differences and the very leftists and the rightists and so on. At this point, this party seems to be organizing its policy agenda in a kind of synthetic and collaborative way. In terms of the second point, I totally agree with everything that Paul said, but you mentioned specifically the ECJ. And coming from law, first I would say that a lawyer, perhaps from this part of the world, will become the new Greek member of the ECJ. And what has happened to the ECJ, I mean, just to confirm a point that Paul was making, is that while the institution and constitution of the EU, certainly before Maastricht, did not have neoliberalism in its founding principles, it was a number of policy decisions, including the ECJ, decisions like Viking and LaSalle and so on, which constitutionalized that kind of attitude towards trade unions, towards social service and so on. And it seems to me that precisely the kind of challenge that you are going to get from those people with the culture that Paul mentioned so correctly will perhaps start moving towards what I called a paradigm shift, using the term from Kuhn's idea of the structure of scientific revolutions. In order to start thinking differently and even start changing it, someone has to stand up and give a different way of understanding the world. And it seems to me that this is what Syriza, both in terms of its policy but in terms of its institutional presence, will be doing in the next few months and years.
Thank you. Yes, sorry.
PhD student.
Hi.
Thank you. Come on.
Okay. My question is, okay. I stopped following the crisis in Greece in 2011 because of such a comment made by Merkel. It was a frightening moment for me. And she made this comment, I'm going to read it to you. She said, "No one should think a further half century of peace and prosperity is assured. If euro fails, Europe will fail." So I'd like to ask a couple of questions regarding this comment. First of all, starting with Simona, do you think a Europe will fail if today Greece leaves the Eurozone? And I'd like to ask Simon, how shall we approach the discourse of this leader who served Germany for 10 years? Because I was frightened with this comment. And Costas, how shall we negotiate with the lady who treating my future of my children?
How
can you negotiate with the leader who threatened the future of Europe?
Okay. I mean, this is for me a little bit of a science fiction question, because I don't think the euro will fail. In the sense, I don't never believe that there will be a collapse of the eurozone as a consequence of everything happened in the last 5 years. And I don't even believe, even if Greece was out of the eurozone, which I don't think it will, I don't think the eurozone will collapse. So I, despite what she said, there might have been a negotiating point, something like either you do what I say or I would make this whole thing collapse. But it's really not the case. It's not particularly not in the interest of, let's call it Germany, but we can even call them the dominant socioeconomic sectors in Germany. And that means that it's incredibly unlikely that this scenario will happen, unless there is something which is a little bit more related to the global political economy. So if there were a situation in which, like, for example, Germany become, like say, independent from the eurozone and from Europe and from the EU, in that case, the euro could collapse. But this is clearly not the case at the moment. And so, I mean, she said it, but it's not something that I believe in.
Yes, I'm not sure whether to believe that either. I think you can start following the crisis again. I think I've been in rooms with German bankers, and it is fearsome. It's a face that when you're with British bankers, it's like a kind of bumbling, trying to keep it together without it all falling apart. But with the German bankers I've met, it's far more absolute clarity on what needs to be done, and absolute clarity that there's going to be no debt cancellation for Greece. If you think about that, no debt cancellation, that also means no guilt cancellation again. So there's that attitude. But on the other hand, I think there will be a deal. I think that there's a pragmatism too. And the reason I think that there is a pragmatism too is because I actually disagree with something that's been saying, well, it's sort of been said without being said, of that neoliberalism is austerity politics. Neoliberalism is far, far bigger than austerity politics. It's about efficiency, performativity, optimization of economies, and about amelioration of conditions of conflict. Mm. And I think a neoliberal outlook, which probably replaced very classical emancipatory narratives, is so well installed that getting rid of austerity can be absolutely part of a neoliberal response. So I'm not, on the one hand, I think, although I find the German resolve quite scary to witness because we're not used to that, I also think there's a sufficient German pragmatism which will mean that actually a deal will be done in one way or another. And I also think that people who are saying that the end of austerity may be with us. I think that if the economic conditions allow it, that'll be the case too. But don't be fooled to think that that's the end of neoliberalism, because neoliberalism isn't about the politics of austerity. However, if austerity goes, that will be a good thing.
I think the question to me was answered earlier, so let us have some more questions here.
Damien Chalmers here from the LSC. I have a question. Am I going to ask the panel to put them forwards to, say, June, and ask, I'm going to ask them, what happens then? Because there is, and this is unfortunate, that there is no new money for Greece, or very little. The terms, just maybe by the February the 28th, the terms might be softened. It's highly unlikely there will be any debt cancellation because most of the debt is publicly held, so it's a choice between Portuguese pensioners or Greek pensioners paying for it. The structure of quantitative easing is such there cannot be much risk sharing, so relatively little of it can go to Greece. So there will be relatively little money or capital for Greece, which is still largely shut out of the capital markets. Their banks are wrecked and heavily undercapitalized. What happens in June? when we talk about all these new models, when the reality is that whilst Greece remains part of the euro, there is nothing that can really help finance many of these things. I accept there might be softening. And we can talk about states that have left the ESM, and Portugal is perhaps the best case study. I would suggest anyone that thinks Portugal, particularly after today's GDP figures, is a good case study, should look at its current stock exchange and see where it was compared just to 6 months ago. And Greece is way behind Portugal now, even if it wasn't for the current terms of the two bailout plans.
Just way behind.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the economic cycle, in terms of where it is, in terms of getting back to a decent, if you like, stage of living. And so my question is, what happens politically and economically in 4 months? We can talk about the end of neoliberalism, but I think, and it's a euphoric moment, of course, but I worry it's just the euphoric moment before a much longer, harsher reality dawns.
Okay, now is a euphoric moment, you know? I mean, we've been so used to being defeated and failing and so on, so perhaps, you know, we deserve it, you know, for another month or so, a kind of extended honeymoon period. But in answer to your question now more specifically, Greece became insolvent back in 2009 and 10. And by insolvent, I mean that they could not pay back their loans, you know, the installments for their loans, the bonds that were maturing. So it was insolvent, but it didn't go bankrupt. Why? Because the bailout, which were loans, as you know, kept giving money to the Greek government. This money was going to an escrow account and was more or less immediately going back to the banks. According to some calculations I've seen, 90% of the loan money was going back to repay earlier loans. In other words, you were borrowing on the Visa to pay the MasterCard, and that meant that overall debt and the repayment and so on, you know, sort of went up. So to that extent, Greece was insolvent, but as Varoufakis, I think, quite nicely puts it, the insolvency was treated as a question or a problem of liquidity. In other words, get money to go back. The position of the Greek government, and I fully agree, I'm sure that Paul knows more about these matters, is that to the extent that a debt, which is 185% of GDP, is unviable according to most theoretical positions and institutional positions, the IMF and the rest of it, something will have to give. In other words, that debt will have to be negotiated down by some percentage. And this is the whole point of asking for this period of the interit agreement or the loaning or the bridging loan, whatever, the bridging agreement. And during that period, the government will precisely negotiate what happens with the debt and the repayment of the debt, how much of the debt gets written down, and so on and so forth. So that is the position. And, I mean, just to finish, it seems to me, going back to what we were saying earlier, that your question precisely reflects the kind of current, you know, orthodoxy which finds only one way of dealing with these problems, perhaps the Portuguese way, and you may have heard that the Portuguese and the Spanish prime ministers yesterday in the summit meeting were the people who, particularly the Spanish guy, Rajoy, argued against Tsipras again and again and again, saying that you cannot do the kinds of things you want. Here we have a political problem. These are governments that go into polls later this year. They fear that if Tsipras win, against the interests of their countries, because they could then try to claim similar concessions for their own debt. But if Tsipras win, then of course those governments will fall, will lose their elections. So we have, again, it seems to me, a certain shift in the way that people see how the world works.
Paul, would you like to say that?
Yeah, I think they can run a primary surplus. They're going to probably be told to run a primary surplus higher than they want to, but they're currently running a primary surplus. And therefore, they don't need to borrow from anybody. They need to finance short-term the government, and that is their problem. But if they get the deal through to September, what I would expect is that Greece actually is a state where if you can tap into the euphoria to get the retail taxpayer to start paying, because there's been a tax strike in the run-up to the election, and actual income, you know, there's been they are short of tax dollars. If you can
If Syriza goes to them and says, well, you have to start paying, everybody has to start paying the tax, just the ordinary taxpayer, that, plus the prime, you know, carrying on with the primary surplus, can I think get them through? Then you look at the debt, and what you say is right about the German attitude to debt cancellation. But even Samaras was trying to negotiate a debt rollover, because all the repayments to the official sector, there's a big spike this year, and then they mainly come 2022, 23, 24 in big 15 billion wedges that nobody's ever going to be able to pay. Mm. I would imagine if Samaras had been prime minister now, the deal would have been we roll that over for 60 years. You know, that's what was being discussed. So I think, as you know, if you know about debt, if you pay zero interest and pay off when your grandchildren are dead, that's a bit like writing it off. Actuaries can turn the one into the other. So I would expect that is the direction that it's going to go in. But I am more pessimistic about the euro, because for me, the last throw of the dice is QE. And they have to do QE right, and I think that there'll be an incentive on Draghi to do it far more American style than it seems that he's going to do it. That is far more targeted, and that for there to be under pressure from, this is where Hollande and Renzi come in, pressure from Hollande and Renzi to do far more in terms of making real this 300 billion Juncker infrastructure plan. And Greece only needs a few billion of that. So I think that is the issue. There is, however, you know, a remaining issue of whether the Eurozone institutions do hold up and execute it. And we are in a period where the currency war in the world is wiping out everybody who's small. The Swiss, the Danish, the Swedes, they've all had to do incredibly unorthodox policy just to survive what's been going on the last few weeks. So if QE does not work for the Eurozone, then it'll be in the Eurozone's interest to move to fiscal stimulus. And that's where I think the final point, because I'm rabbiting on. In conservative circles in Britain, the other scenario is Le Pen. If Le Pen wins, the Brits are out of the EU. I can tell you, if Le Pen wins and Cameron wins, the Brits will leave the EU. They are not going to interoperate in EU institutions with a Nazi. Okay? Now, that's what they say, and I think it'll give them the casus belli to just blow the EU up. So we have to factor that in as well.
May I say something? I mean, it's related to what Paul was saying. I agree completely, but if you listen to what he was saying, the problem is not Greece or Syriza. The problem is deflation. QE is about deflation. The problem for the Eurozone and for Europe is not Syriza. It's not even austerity. And maybe, I mean, I agree with some of the reasons that we had discussed, what it means, neoliberalism. It's a long story. We don't want to address it now. But basically, the problem is nothing to do with the austerity, with Greece. It's got to do with the fact that we are in a very dire situation, in a mess. Mm. And the reason is not, it's because they got it wrong. And they got it wrong from the beginning, because QE should have been done. I mean, this is kids, whatever should have been done. In 2008, as they did it in this country, as they did it in the US. They didn't do it, and this is where we are. But it's not, I mean, if the problem were all in Greece, it wouldn't even be a big problem. I think it's completely true. I mean, QE should be, but Draghi will do it in the way they left to do it, because now there is consensus about that.
I think we've been focusing on Greece as if it was the problem.
Yeah.
And of course there's a huge sense in which it's not the problem at all, and the dimension, whether it was in or out, wouldn't make much difference to the future of the Eurozone in terms of its banking crises or anything like that. The Euro has...
Of course, this is focusing on Greece as if it's the solution.
Yeah, well, of course, that was the lovely story. And of course, mustn't forget that Kostas told us a story in which it could be a model for something altogether different. The other... sort of difficult side for that nice story is that I think you said that the sort of thing that can interrupt it is events.
Sure.
Yeah, the unanticipatable, and the events that could well interrupt the Greek movements would be an ongoing crisis in the Eurozone. Sure. And I think that's
The Greek movement was an event, in a sense.
Yes, but I think if you get a crisis, a serious crisis in the Eurozone, or a crisis in European politics, sure, of the sort that Paul's just described with the Le Pen victory, this will have its effects on the developments in Greece too. And I think whilst Kostas was confident that the narcissism of minor differences would belong to a stage of the left in retreat, I'm not so confident that really a coalition on the left can hold itself together and that people like Varoufakis would quickly see themselves in a very difficult position.
Right, well, I think we'll have to wrap this up. Just one note. I mean, I think what's really important is what Paul and the rest of the panel have noticed, that the Greek government is now rallying up popular support in Greece. I mean, it was unprecedented that there was a demonstration in support of the government with no police to be seen anywhere. And this is happening all over Europe, too. The second round is this Sunday, and it's in London, it's at Trafalgar Square. I can't remember what time.
1 o'clock.
Yes. 1 o'clock. Now, this is important, I think, and this draws on a lot of the things that our panel has said, that popular support, pressure from the bottom up, may be a catalyst in all this story, especially in countries such as Portugal and Spain, where there is this practice of blackmailing the Spanish and Portuguese population. When Mr. Rajoy comes out and says, no Podemos, no Podemos, in a rather clumsy way, of course, you know, just turning Podemos against them by just adding no. This is the kind of thing that he would not be able to do if there is support from the bottom up. Right, anyway, I won't go on. Before we thank our panel, let me plug another related event next week on Tuesday, the 17th of February at 6:30 here in this same room. Colleagues from the Law Department, Professor Chalmers, Professor Carl Harlow, Professor Dr. Jan Komarek, and Dr. Merkens, he's at the back there, will be talking not about a country that wants to stay in Europe and others want it out, but a country that may want to leave the EU, and that's the UK. So the theme of the event is leaving the EU, question mark. Right. Please join me in thanking our panel, Simona Talani, Paul Mason, Simon Glendinning, Kostas Luzinas, and thank you very much.